had decided that they needed to stop the Marquis from going to Paris and assassinating the Tsar. And they decided the best way to do that was to challenge him to a duel. And I thought it was very humorous the way Syme asked the Marquis, "Permit me to pull your nose." And then goes off and says, "Oh, this man has just insulted me." And the Marquis says, no, I haven't. And Syme goes, "Yes, you insulted my mother." And the Marquis goes, "No, I haven't." And Syme says, "Well, okay, then you insulted my aunt." The Marquis says, "No, my only comment was that, I like Wagner when he's played well." And Syme says, "Well, you were alluding to my family. I had an aunt that played Wagner very badly, and we were always being made fun of, and so you insulted me because you brought it up. It's a sore topic." And Dr. Bull and the professor, as Syme's seconds, they inform the Marquis that the only time that Syme has to participate in this duel is right before the train leaves. And, of course, as we discussed last week, the Marquis, being a man of honor, he can't run away from the duel. He must engage in it. And so he agrees. And they meet in a small meadow near the train station where they can see the tracks. They'd be able to see when the train's approaching. And there's about 20 minutes that they have before the train comes. And so Syme knows that he just needs to detain the Marquis for 20 minutes, and then he would miss the train and would not be able to assassinate the Tsar. And we're introduced to a new character here, the Colonel Ducroix. He is another policeman, like a member of the Legion of Honor, which I'm not exactly sure what that group is. I assume it's a branch of the police force, but I could be wrong. I wanted to read one of the paragraphs from the moment the two blades of the swords touch. Syme feels these two fears. And the narrative reads, "When the jar of the joined iron ran up Syme's arm, all the fantastic fears that have been the subject of this story fell from him like dreams from the man waking up in bed. He remembered them clearly and in order as mere delusions of the nerves, how the fear of the professor had been the fear of the tyrannic accidents of nightmare, and how the fear of the doctor had been the fear of the airless vacuum of science. The first was the old fear that any miracle might happen, the second the more hopeless modern fear that no miracle can ever happen. But he saw that these fears were fancies, for he found himself in the presence of the great fact of the fear of death, with its coarse and pitiless common sense. He felt like a man who had dreamed all night of falling over precipices, and had woke up on the morning when he was to be hanged." I thought that was very interesting, the two different fears that they present here. And let me ask you which one you think is the worst, the old fear that any miracle might happen, or the fear that no miracle could ever happen. What do you think?
The worst fear would be that no miracle could ever happen.
Why?
Because that means lots of hope. So if you get to a point where no miracle could ever happen, you're in such a broken state that you're just lost. And that would be, I think, far worse than the fear of death or the fear of anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Because that signs a lack of hope. And sometimes it's all something to have.
Right.
That's a very good answer. Mm-hmm. I think that if we live in a world where no miracles happen, that means we live in a personal machine where everything's basically a channel of things.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting. My very first thought when I thought of the phrase that any miracle might happen reminded me of the movie Jumanji with Robin Williams. I don't know if anyone's seen it. I think it was a book, too. You might have read the book. But it's the story of a man who gives these two boys a board game. And as they start playing the board game, they realize that everything that happens in the board game starts happening to them in real life as well. And I don't remember, maybe there was a dinosaur stampede or, you know, all these fantastical things start happening to them because they're happening in the board game. And it was funny, my mom brought this up a couple days ago, and I don't remember why, but she was saying how fun that movie was to watch, and I looked at her, and I was like, Mom, that movie was terrifying when I was a child. And it was the unpredictability that, you know, anything could happen, that really scared me when I was little. So at first, I definitely thought that any miracle possibly happening was the worst thing that I could definitely think of. But I do think you're right that, it's almost scarier because we can't really imagine a world where no miracle could ever happen. Because that would be a world with no hope. I thought it was, these two fears kind of, paralleled happiness versus joy. You know, of course, today everyone makes a big deal about being happy. Yes, people always have made a big deal about being happy. And of course, a lot of people have approached it the wrong way, trying to take a more hedonistic approach, just, you know, purely trying to enjoy the pleasures of the world. But joy is a very different thing than mere happiness is. Joy is a deep, profound sense of contentment and peace that really you don't get from anywhere except God. So I think that the fear that any miracle might happen is akin to, you know, happiness on the other end of the scale. And in the same way, the fear that no miracle can ever happen is akin to, joy. It's also interesting. After that paragraph, the narrative goes on to describe, how when Syme's faced with this fear of death, he is all of a sudden very conscious of the beauty of life around him. He notices the flowers that are blossoming in the meadow, and the skyline, the trees. He's all of a sudden very appreciative of life. And this kind of reminded me of, we were talking about the officers and their diets, how some of them ate very voraciously, and those were the characters that were full of life and full of action. And the ones with the more feeble diets were the ones who were more nihilistic and didn't have a sense of the joy of life in them. So I think this reinforces how much better it is to be men of action and to be full of that vitality of life. So here again, we see the nightmare, a nightmarish theme. Syme keeps stabbing the Marquis, but the Marquis never bleeds. And there's one point where his sword goes into him, and the sword even bends under the Marquis's body weight. And, you know, you'd think that'd be proof that the sword is going into him, but when it comes out, there's no blood. I think we've all had nightmares, you know, where we're fighting someone and, you know, they just keep getting stronger. I was reminded of, I think it's Hydra, the monster who you cut off one of their heads and, you know, two more grow in its place. You know, you think you're overcoming them, you think you're winning, and then you realize, oh no, this is actually just making them stronger. And eventually, time is going on, and the train comes into the station, and the Marquis realizes that, you know, he doesn't really have time for this. He needs to go. And he stops, and he says, he tells Sign that, you know, originally he had asked to pull his nose as a sign of challenge for the duel. And he says, "Sign, pull my nose now." And Sime does, and his nose comes off. And then the Marquis continues to take his left eyebrow off and other parts of his face, and Colonel Ducroix becomes furious, and he says, "You know, this man is cheated. He's been using padding. And that's how he has been able to withstand all these hits with the sword without getting injured." And the Marquis says that the reason that he's wearing padding isn't because he's trying to cheat, trying to get out of the duel. He's wearing padding because he's in disguise, and he's actually Inspector Radcliffe, also of the police. And so we find that all four of these men, and all five, I guess, including Gogol, besides Sunday and Monday, his secretary, these men have all been policemen this entire time. And Mrs. Marshall was saying before, for those of you who weren't here at the beginning of class, that, you know, how every, you know, this keeps happening, you know, they keep getting distracted trying to follow each other around, and they all just end up being policemen. And, you know, it was fun and exciting and surprising the first couple times around, but definitely when I got to this section, I kind of felt like, oh, okay, yeah, you know, is even, my mom said, you know, is even Sunday going to be a policeman? Is that what we're going to find out? But Inspector Radcliffe, he proposes that this has been Sime's intention, Sunday's intention all along, that he's a smart man, and he knows that in order to waste their time, it'd be best if he pitted them against each other. Says the old devil, meaning Sunday, put them on the Supreme Council to waste their time watching each other. I think this is very, you know, this is very typical of Satan himself to try to distract us from the things that are really important. I had a friend post something on Facebook when there was a whole uproar about the gorilla, the boy falling in the gorilla pit. And of course, media made such a huge deal about this. And my friend's very politically minded, and he posted that, meanwhile, while the media is making this huge deal about this gorilla, look at these bills that the Democrats are trying to pass in Congress. And he suggested that perhaps the media was intentionally drawing our attention away from, you know, these bills, the things that are really important, to make us focus on something that really doesn't matter as much. So the Marquis says that, of course, him being a policeman, he was not truly going to assassinate the Tsar, but he still needed to catch the train so that he'd be able to stop Sunday and his secretary. And as people are leaving the trains, are disembarking from the train, there's a huge group of people that are coming towards Sime and everyone else in the meadow, and Conveniently, the Marquis just happens to be carrying some opera glasses on him, and so they look through those, and yeah, very convenient. And they see that they're all wearing masks, and it says that they notice that one of them smiled on one side. I don't know if you remember the description of the secretary Monday at the beginning. Sime was rather disturbed by his crooked smile, and so we see that the secretary and his mob is approaching Sime and our heroes. Does anyone have any comments before we move on? Any questions? Yes.
It's interesting, though, Chester, that sometimes what you're saying, like some things that maybe are not necessary for the narrative but still enrich the story, like the idea of when the guy is facing the reality of possible death, how all of the world seems to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I also thought, I just got a sense that yesterday was mocking dual mentality where you hold honor above all things and you get to put your life on the line over whether or not you're on your way, rock or well. I think you can be having fun with some of these people, quibbles that we have.
For sure. I mean, Chesterton tried to have fun in everything. So. All right. So, as the mob approaches them, our heroes decide to retreat to the woods instead of confronting. They're going to run, try to get away. I think it's very interesting that they retreat into the woods. Here's a description of the woods from Sime's perspective. The fancy tinted Sime's overwhelming sense of wonder. Was he wearing a mask? Was anyone wearing a mask? Was anyone anything? This wood of witchery in which men's faces turn black and white by turns, in which their figures first swelled into sunlight and then faded into formless night, this mere chaos of chiaroscuro, after the clear daylight outside, seemed to Sime a perfect symbol of the world in which he had been moving for 3 days. This world where men took off their beards and their spectacles and their noses and turned into other people. That tragic self-confidence which he had felt when he believed that the Marquis was a devil had strangely disappeared now that he knew the Marquis was a friend. He felt almost inclined to ask, after all these bewilderments, what was a friend and what an enemy? Was there anything that was apart from what it seemed? The Marquis had taken off his nose and turned out to be a detective. Might he not just as well take off his head and be a hobgoblin? Was not everything, after all, like this bewildering woodland? I think I see this a lot in literature, the woods being symbolic of a place where things are not what they seem, a very mystical, magical kind of place. Shakespeare used it in A Midsummer Night's Dream. The village is where everything normal happens, and when everyone goes into the woods that night, weird things start to happen. And this device is also used in Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter, where again everything in the village seems normal, but in the woods the heroine, I guess you could call her, she finds an escape, and she finds again, that things are not what they seem. Things are always different in the woods. Oh, right. Where actual witchcraft happens. So that was, I don't know, I thought that was very interesting. And as they're walking, Sime makes a comment about the working men, and Inspector Ratcliffe responds to this. And Chesterton is definitely known as being a champion of the poor. He always stood up for the poor and the working class. And so I think he speaks through Inspector Radcliffe here. Says, you talk about mobs and the working classes as if they were the question. You've got the eternal idiotic idea that if anarchy came, it would come from the poor. Why should it? The poor have been rebels, but they have never been anarchists. They have been more interested than anyone else in there being some decent government. The poor man really has a stake in the country. The rich man hasn't. He can go away to New Guinea in a yacht. The poor have sometimes objected to being governed badly. The rich have always objected to being governed at all. I think I talked a little bit in my first class about how a lot of times people think that because a man is more wealthy or more successful, more powerful, that his decisions and his actions carry more weight. Might say they're more important than the actions of a lesser man, but Chesterton definitely held the belief that that every action or every decision made by any man carries an equal weight, no matter how much it, you know, whether it influences on a large scale or a small one.
Marxist doctrine would say that it's the proletariat that's bring about the revolution. In fact, it was guided and engineered by intelligentsia.
Mm-hmm.
So, just like you said.
Right. I actually I brought this book with me, Roger Scruton's Fools, Frauds, and Firebrands, Thinkers of the New Left. And I was going to save this for the end, but it's actually very relevant to this. It's discussing the, like you said, the social and political things that were happening at the time. And it really shows how Chesterton's, like you said, the Russian Revolution didn't happen until 1917. And this was written in 1908, but I think Chesterton, you know, maybe had the foresight that this was all coming.
You know, they always say we're here to represent the poor, defend the poor man and the working class. It's the working class that suffers.
Right. Right, well, I will read a little bit of this. Very interesting, and it talks again about how this is a war of words, not just of actions. We owe the term newspeak to George Orwell's chilling portrait of a fictitious totalitarian state. But the capture of language by the left is far older, beginning with the French Revolution and its slogans. When it took the turn that fascinated Orwell, it was with the Socialist International and the eager engagement of the Russian intelligentsia. Those who emerged triumphant from the Second International in 1889 had been granted a vision of a transformed world. This Gnostic revelation was so clear that no argument was necessary and no argument possible that would provide it with a justifying proof. From the beginning, therefore, labels were required that would stigmatize the enemies within and justify their expulsion. They were revisionists, deviationists, infantile leftists, utopian socialists, social fascists, and so on. The success of those labels in marginalizing and condemning the opponent fortified the communist conviction that you could change reality by changing words. Newspeak occurs whenever the primary purpose of language, which is to describe reality, is replaced by the rival purpose of asserting power over it. The fundamental speech act is only superficially represented by the assertoric grammar. Newspeak sentences sound like assertions, but their underlying logic is that of the spell. They conjure the triumph of words over things, the futility of rational argument, and also the danger of resistance. Human individuals are the most important of these real things, the obstacles that all revolutionary systems must overcome and which all ideologies must destroy. So again, Chesterton was very prescient in this book. It's Roger Scruton's Fools, Frauds, and Firebrands. I haven't read the entire book myself, but I thought that section was very relevant to what we're talking about. Exactly.
But they get, it's almost like they present arguments to the poor or to the general population that they believe. You know, that, yeah, I believe it, and so now they get the poor to be assholes, and then it's like they're using this puppet. You know, instead of saying, you know, we want to help you, the goal to, it seems like the goal to be, we want to make it so that you can help yourself.
Mm-hmm. Right, and there are a lot of ideologies like socialism that look really, or sound really good in theory. It looks really good on paper, but the actual practice of it is detrimental. Exactly.
That would be the theme of John Brown and Robespierre and probably several other revolutionaries.
Mm. All right, well, they end up meeting one such working class man, and they haggle with him to get him to give them a ride on his cart. And they arrive at an inn where they feed and water themselves and acquire horses to carry them onward. And that is all the time we have for today. Will anyone close us in prayer?